Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. If you are looking for the regular weekly Risky Business Podcast, this isn't it. This is not one of those. Do scroll one episode back in your podcast feed to find the show where we talk about the news. This is a Soapbox edition, and Soapbox is the wholly sponsored podcast series we do here at Risky Biz HQ, and that means everyone you hear in one of these Soapbox podcasts paid to be here. And this edition of the show is brought to you by Fastly. Fastly acquired one of our long-term sponsors, Signal Sciences, which is how, Fastly became a Risky Biz sponsor. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, Fastly is a CDN company, but obviously they're pushing heavily into security with things like the Signal Sciences acquisition. But today we're not talking about web app security at scale, a la Signal Sciences and the Fastly integration. We're talking about the dumbest category of attacks that can affect your business or organization, DDoS attacks. And our guest is Sean Leach, the Chief Product Architect with Fastly. And basically we talk about the history of DDoS attacks through the ages, how CDNs changed the game, and how it's a crime type that just doesn't seem to want to die, despite the fact it never seems to make any real money for criminals, when compared to things like BEC and ransomware anyway. So we'll start here where Sean talks about the first DDoS attack he had to respond to 20 years ago, and the target, funnily enough, was a Tapestry website. Here's Sean Leach.
For me, it goes back to when I was running an ISP, running engineering and operations for an ISP back in 2000 in Southern California. And I was pretty new into this IT world or the tech world. And we were a hosting company, and we had a Tapestry company as one of our, they had an e-commerce site that we hosted. And all of a sudden one day, we just got a tremendous amount of traffic to this Tapestry company, amazing amounts of traffic. And when we really dug into it, we saw that it was just repeated requests over and over and over again. And I hadn't even really heard of DDoS before. I was seriously 2 years out of college or university. And long story short, we found out it was one Tapestry company DDoSing another Tapestry company to try and take their business, right? If their site was not up, then the customers would have to go to another Tapestry company. So if you never knew that, the Tapestry industry is cutthroat, or at least it was.
Oh man, there's been a series of articles over the last few years here in Australia about the bouncy castle wars in Australia, where a bouncy castle operator was doing violent standover stuff to the other bouncy castle guys and burning down their storage and pretty crazy. So, I'll drop a link in to the show notes about the bouncy castle wars, because You just gave me an excuse to do that. People will find it funny. But it is interesting, right, when we go back 20 years ago, because I remember those days too. And what was a remarkable feature of DDoS attacks back then is data center links were not big, right? So you would have a DDoS crew targeting one, as you say, a Tapestry company that was a, VPS host, right?
Yep.
And it would take down the whole data center.
And VPSs weren't even that popular back then, right? It was generally bare metal.
Yeah.
And the attackers too, compared to now with these massive IoT botnets, the attackers were generally sitting behind dial-up or DSL lines that really had maybe a megabit a second of capacity. So you'd have to have a pretty tremendous number of clients, even though the data center links were generally relatively small as well. You might have 100 megabits per second. So it's just the scale is astronomical now, of terabits a second versus, megabits a second.
So, back then, it'd be helpful because it's a bigger industry now. A lot of people not been in it for 20 years. Back then, how would you mitigate something like that? Because, if I remember correctly, it was a lot of phone calls with your upstream providers and then them talking to their upstream providers and onwards from there. But it was was manual, and it was annoying.
Yeah, a lot of it was who you knew, right? Did you know the person at NTT who had enable on the router, who could filter IP addresses for you? There was no number you called unless you had met that person at Nanog or one of those kind of industry events back in the day. But for that attack, it was relatively simple as well. I just had a Python script that parsed the Apache logs, and they were not very intelligent in how they did the attack. You could spot exactly the string in the Apache logs, and then you just ran IP tables every 30 seconds and pushed in a new IP address as you parse those logs. So the complexity of tax is far bigger now. But back then, it, like I said, it was still new. I didn't know what this thing was. I learned a ton. It was a lot of fun to, you know, now looking back.
Yeah, yeah. So where did it evolve from there, though? Because, I mean, that was like the early history. I mean, you're talking about an attack that was doing some sort of, you know, GET request or whatever, right? You know, exactly. Actually targeting the web application, which is still a technique people use today, particularly when they can throw a GET request at an application that makes it do some sort of computationally intensive query, right? That's a gold technique. At this point, it might actually make sense to explain what the different types of DDoS attacks are, because you've got your volumetric attacks, you've got your application-specific attacks. You know, what you described was kind of a generic web application technique, but from there, you know, that being the first one you saw, I'm sure you saw the others as well, right?
Yeah, like if I look back at the history of my kind of like career, I've been involved in, gosh, if you look at any of the big attacks over the past, I was involved in some way, whether it was the GitHub, attacks with China and the Great Firewall, the Blue Security attacks. I can talk about that one. That was a very interesting one back in the day. To even now with the Mirai and the Maris and even the GitLab attack that just came out, I think yesterday, where you had compromised GitLab instances that had a remote command execution vulnerability, and people are now launching big attacks based on that. They all have always come down to very related types of attacks, right? It's, you call it volumetric, sometimes people call it network-based, but basically it's just throw a whole lot of packets at a thing, because that thing either doesn't have the bandwidth to handle it, or the router or the switching infrastructure.
Yeah, it's like other people call it like link saturation attacks or whatever, but it's the same thing.
Exactly.
Tomato, tomato, some, right?
Yeah, or they'll call them uncomplicated attacks, even though I've seen some that are extremely complicated. And then it goes all the way up to the application-based attack. That's where it's much more difficult to spot, because it looks like a real user, right? No real user just blasts, 100 gigabits a second of ICMP packets at a network, but a real user will click the add to cart button. And so if you can script that, that's a very complex attack that looks like a real user. And usually you'll hear that called like a layer 7 or an application layer attack.
Mm. So walk us through, as you said, you've been around, you've been front row for a lot of these things. Can you walk us through some of them, walk us through some of the more interesting ones that you've experienced?
Yeah, for sure. Like I was kind of, as I get more gray hair, I have to write things down and research things to remember what I did back in the day. I did that for this particular podcast, where I looked back at the attacks that I had been a part of, and I kind of refreshed some of the knowledge and some of the experiences that I had had during those. And so it was pretty interesting. I think the next one after the Tapestry, wars of 2000, I guess we'll call them
the
now.
Tapestry Wars. I love it.
The next one I think I was involved in was back in the day, there was this software called Blue Security, and it was one of the early ways of trying to stop spam. You basically would register with this software and point it at a known spammer, and they would submit comments to the website of the particular spammer. And just to kind of like, it was almost like a reverse Joe job, right? Where you're trying to just flood this spammer with comments or criticism, was not to try and stop them from doing what they're doing. And it sounded like a great idea, right? Like a community driven, stop sending spam at me type of environment. The problem was they didn't like that. And so the spammers, and so they decided to attack Blue Security. And there's some great art, if you read the Wikipedia on it, it's pretty interesting, the history around it. But at the time, I was working for a company that did managed DNS, which is a company called Ultra DNS. And we were hosting the DNS for the Blue Security at the time.
And let me guess where the attackers tried to, what they targeted, right?
Exactly. They targeted us, and they targeted their blogging platform. And it's a small world. Our founder at Fastly was actually at the blogging platform at SixApart at the time. I was at Ultra DNS, and we both got a massive amount of traffic, or DDoS attack traffic, thrown at both of us, right? Just trying to take this company down. And at the end, the company ended up giving up. Like, unfortunately, the attackers won in that round and were able to convince them not to do this business model anymore. And so that's where you had a DDoS take an entire business down And really, like, I haven't seen anybody try and do something similar since then. There's been attacks similar ones against SpamHaus. You know, they're similar. They're a spam RBL. And attackers will go after them as well, just trying to take them down so nobody can depend on them anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an open question about whether you can really depend on SpamHaus for reliable information. But
back in the day, they were much more reliable, but now, yeah.
Back in the day, they were it, right? But they were also, yes. Like, for people who weren't there at the time, all of these, like, big RBLs were kind of high on power a little, right? You would admit. Like, if you accidentally got added to one of their block lists, you would have to, you know, get on your knees and beg, and they enjoyed it. They really enjoyed it.
Very much. It was not easy to get off those lists. and then another one that was interesting, right around the same time, I found we hosted a lot of DNS. We also had some TLD DNS. So not just like companies DNS, but like top level domain DNS. And we had .info on us. And at the time, nobody used .info. So all of a sudden .info was getting attacked. Again, a DNS based, what's called a reflection attack, where an attacker will send a spoofed packet at a bunch of DNS servers, and they'll spoof the destination that they want to attack as the source of the packet, so that the DNS software, when it gets the request, responds to that spoofed address, right? UDP allows you to do that. It's one of the flaws of UDP.
Well, it's one of the advantages of UDP.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
stateless.
Sure.
It's awesome. Too, you know, come on.
Depending on who you ask, yes. But I remember getting on the call when we got the attack against us, and back then info was really new, and I'm like, who would attack .info? Like, nobody was on it at the time. Like, it was the most like interesting attack, or I don't know if they were just testing their cannon or whatnot, but it was, you know, because most of the time DDoS attacks are either financially motivated or I would say politically motivated. I've been a part of some of those as well. And that one, we never could figure out why they were going after .info, but it was really the first big DNS amplification or reflection attack that I had personally seen in the business.
It's funny, right? Because DNS amplification, I mean, as far as I know, like, it's still something that works depending on which DNS servers you're targeting. But, you know, we've seen a whole host over the last couple of decades, a whole host of different protocols that are being abused to do reflection attacks. I mean, SNMP was a big one. I think there was even some NTP techniques as well, network time protocol based techniques. But yeah, essentially, if you can find public servers or things that are just made available, like in common devices or whatever, services that are made available in common devices that can respond with UDP. Yeah, you're going to be able to do these types of reflection attacks where you send, you know, 100 bytes, and that server will then send a kilobyte to the target. And some of these, you know, multipliers that you get out of these reflection attacks are huge, right?
Yeah, yeah, especially like you throw like DNSSEC into that, where you're basically returning.
Yeah, yeah. Send all your keys, amounts. Please.
Yeah. that can be a 18 byte or a 40 byte question that comes back with a 4 kilobyte response, and you then, you know, tie that to all the open DNS recursives out there. And that there's enough there. The SSDP was one that was attacked quite a bit, as like you called out NTP, and that was one of the things people worried about with QUIC as well. Right, one of the strengths of HTTP was that it was TCP based, or HTTP 1, you know, and HTTP 2 was TCP based. With QUIC, which is, you know, HTTP 3, that's UDP based.
What? And so I didn't know this.
Yeah, so that's one of the worries. I mean, QUIC's amazing; it provides so much value, but that is one of the concerns people have had about it.
Hang on, you telling me we're doing the web over UDP now?
And it is. Like I said, it's a ton of value. Like you said, UDP, depending on who you ask, UDP, like QUIC does some pretty amazing things
it's
when
QUIC.
It comes to like glossy networks, right? It's in the name.
Yeah.
But it is a UDP. There is quite a bit of UDP in that protocol.
Okay. Well, that's you learn something every day. So thank you for that rather grim update, because that's trouble down the line. I think though, like, it feels like DDoS was a big thing 20 years ago, right? And, you know, why don't you refresh people's memories on Mafia Boy, right? Because that was when it was peak hype, the first go around. I think, what was that, like 99 or something, 1999, around then?
Yes, that's 2000, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
And that's the first time it was really in the news, right? They were, Mafia Boy was able to take down some sites that were behind some pretty powerful and, you know, well-respected networks.
Wasn't it like eBay? Didn't Mafia Boy like take down eBay? And this is just like some kid, right?
Yeah, it was eBay, JP, like Chase, Yahoo, like like the biggest names out there, right? And but back then, again, back to that's the same time as the Tapestry Wars. Like, it just wasn't a thing. Like, it wasn't, nobody thought about it as a thing. And now it's just so much part of the internet that it's like it's everywhere. But back then, nobody knew what it was. Right? No. That was really the first big, I think, public one that everybody read on CNN, which I think also got attacked back then. So
yeah, and it would DDoS mitigation services too back then. If you were a data center that wanted to offer DDoS resistance to your customers, it was such a big investment. And that's something I think people probably wouldn't think about now. Now we live in an age of low cost CDNs and things like that, and upstream providers who are pretty good at handling this stuff, soaking it up, filtering it. But back then, if you wanted to get that, you know, that clean feed from your upstream provider, the costs were quite prohibitive, almost, right? Like it was a thing where a lot of people ran without it because it was just too expensive.
Yeah, and it really started an entire industry of protection, right? So UltraDNS, we were able to charge a tremendous amount of money because we sat in front of not just the Facebooks and the MySpaces, you know, if you remember MySpace, but like the big, you know, known customers back in the day. We had a lot of gambling sites and other sites that paid us a lot of money to protect their DNS from DDoS attacks, right? That we were able to generate quite a bit of revenue from that. And then you had a company like Prolexic, right? They were formed out of that exact same world where, if you've ever read Fatal Systems Error by, I think Joseph Min is who wrote that, it's a pretty interesting account of the founding and history of a company like Prolexic. Again, it was an entire business, an entire, like, you know, security industry was born to protect customers once it became a real thing. And it was really big. I mean, Prolexic was acquired for quite a bit of money by Akamai. Like, when I was at VeriSign, we had an entire business around DDoS protection that generated quite a bit of revenue. And now, like you said, it is much more built into the CDN layer or the cloud layer, like Amazon and Google and Azure. They provide DDoS services.
Well, Arbor Networks is another business that comes to mind, and that was actually co-founded by Doug Song, right, who went on to found Duo. And I think Arbor was really smart because they did what I'd call the BlackBerry model, which is they would sell their gear into the providers so that they could then offer, you know, DDoS resistant services at a premium, right? So they became like, you know, they could make money for the telcos, essentially, which is why their stuff got so popular. And eventually sold to where? I can't even remember where Arbor went. Was it Juniper?
No, they eventually ended up, I think, at like NetScout, but they got acquired by, you know, I'm going to look right now because it's...
we're both sitting here Googling it.
NetScout bought it back in 2015. Yeah.
There you go.
But yeah, they were used by everybody. Like their detection. So they had two things, right? You had the Arbor detection, and then you had the Arbor protection software.
Yeah, and you had one at each end of the link, right? So you had the detection on the downside, and then it could actually manage to pass information up. Sometimes
and look at NetFlow. Look at NetFlow, look at S-Flow, look at router counters. It's much more sophisticated now from a detection perspective, but back then you were really focused at the NetFlow and the SNMP counters and whatnot layer.
Yeah. So at what point did we start turning this into like a CDN solution? Because people forget too that like companies like Akamai, for example, I'm sorry to name one of your competitors in your sponsored interview, but they used to host media for Facebook, right? This is, and I sort of feel like that was the beginning of this sort of CDN era. And of course, companies that size now, they all run their own, right? They're not outsourcing that stuff anymore. But I feel like that was the start of the era when you got these rapidly growing like social network sites and stuff, realizing, geez, we need CDNs, not just for speed, but for resilience. Would you agree that that's sort of when it all started happening in the sort of mid 2000s, you know, with mid to late 2005 to 2010 sort of era?
Yeah, I think so. So like where I saw it was, when CDNs stopped being used just for static content, like images and video and whatnot, and you started putting CDN in front of all of your assets because you got a lot of benefits from a performance perspective of putting your like main website behind as well, right? Your dynamic content. So if you look at the early days of Fastly, you look at Katendo that was acquired by Akamai, those were the first CDNs that all your traffic would really start to go through, your API traffic, your shopping cart traffic. And so once you did that, you had this massive thing sitting in front of your infrastructure. It made sense to do DDoS at that location, right?
It's kind of funny because, I mean, how many case studies can you think of where people kind of coalesced around the right decision? It kind of worked out is what I'm getting at.
It did. Yeah, for speed. Sorry, go ahead.
But see, well, this is where it gets interesting, right? Because there was almost like a decade where DDoS functionally went away. And then you had other CDN providers offering like free tiers, right? You know, when Lulzsec 10 years ago were going around burning stuff down, they were using Cloudflare free tier, which was hilarious because everyone was trying to DOS them all the time. And you go to their site and, you know, you would actually see the little banner saying, you know, Cloudflare was keeping them up. And I think that really drove a big, funnily enough, just Lulzsec did a lot for CDN awareness back then. And that sort of drove this uptake. And it feels like from there, things did drop off for quite some time. Would you agree with that? Or was I just not paying attention?
No, I think you nailed it. And I think it's always been cyclical. It's like for a while there, DDoS was interesting from a money perspective, like take a site down, like, you know, just for like, you know, like I was saying back in the early 2000s. And then it became somewhat of a political statement, right? When Anonymous and like you said,
Fire Lulzsec, cannons. What was it? The low orbit internet cannon or something?
I just remember the acronym of it.
Yeah.
And then we saw some interesting ones around back to political. These were ones that I was involved in pretty heavily. Either sometimes they were called the Al-Qassam attacks or they were called the It's Okay, No Problem, Bro attacks. An interesting reason why it was called that. But that was when they went after the banks, right? Mm-hmm. This was like 2011. And the belief was they were trying to get a video taken down on YouTube that was, you know, that had religious connotations that the attackers didn't appreciate. And so to try and force YouTube to take the video down, they would attack American banks, like the biggest ones in the United States. And these were big DDoS attacks that caused some real damage, right? And so after that, and you stop those, they stopped doing that. And then I think at that point, the resources, it's a financial thing, right? You have these resources, these compromised machines, whatever they are, IoT boxes, Windows PCs, whatever they are. What's the best use of those? If you got a 500,000 of them, what's the best way you can use those? So crypto mining started to take over as something that you could do with them. Like, let's go.
Well, and also renting things. Them out, right? For booting people out of game servers that you didn't like and stuff there like that. Like just weird stuff like that.
The ransomware, like a lot of, I mean, now that's a big thing, but like a lot of the effort of trying to compromise things, I think the attackers were spent on ransomware and more profitable businesses for them there. So the economics of DDoS stopped making sense for the attackers.
Yeah.
But now it's so cheap and so easy to compromise these big IoT boxes.
Well, now there's a monetization vector as well, because you can ask people for Monero or Bitcoin, whereas previously, what were you going to do? Ask them to mail you a check? You know, it didn't really work, right? So so now it does. I suppose this has brought us up to the current era, I'd really say we're in, which is the Mirai era. When did Mirai first happen? Because, you know, everything blurs into one. I've been doing this podcast 15 years, for God's sakes, right? And did reporting before that for years as well, written reporting. So it all sort of blurs together after a while. When did Mirai first surface? Because it's been a while ago. It was a while ago now, right?
Yeah, the when I remember it was really around 2016.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
When they went after Krebs. I think that's when it really, you know, anytime you do anything with Krebs, you're going to get the most publicity out of it. Unfortunately, he just seems to always be, you know, affected by these things. But 2016, Mirai really started to come about. And what you've really seen since then, I think you called it out, you know, before the show, is like everything's just been forked off of Mirai. It's gotten to the point now where any IoT-based attack is probably some
Mirai variant
piece of Mirai. Yes, right.
I guess what's interesting about this though, right? Because we're talking about the economics of it not making sense. There's more money to be made. If you want to put on your black hat, go do ransomware, go do banking Trojans or whatever, although that's got quite hard these days due to improvements in things like phishing detection by the browser makers and banks doing really quite decent fraud and recovery, you know, detection response, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why ransomware is the go-to crime if you actually want to make money. But yet DDoSes persist. And we covered on the show recently, these attacks against VoIP telephony providers. And we're talking about, I think those were between 250, 300 gigabit per second attacks. And of course, targeting VoIP, which is SIP, which is UDP, right? So it's not something you can just throw a traditional CDN in front of and just soak up, right? But I think the ransom demand in one of those attacks was $4,000. Right? It was 4,000 bucks worth of Bitcoin. And you just think that's the thing that jumps out to me about the current status of DDoS attacks is they are almost worthless and yet they're so destructive, right? It's just, it all seems a bit crazy.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. You mentioned you can't just put a CDN in front of these UDP attacks. But I think what you're finding is that I call it like the destination AES compression, right? Where if you think of like back in the day, you had all these data centers where all the servers and the applications were. And so you had all this traffic that would go to all these different destination autonomous systems, right? The internet was a much bigger place. Now it all goes to a very small number of AESs, whether it's Google, Amazon, Cloudflare, Fastly, Akamai. There's not that many destinations of traffic. And so all of those destinations have gotten good at blocking traffic, no matter if it's HTTP or UDP, right? So even if you don't have a CDN in front of your, and SIP, like, you know, VoIP is a combination, there's TCP and there's UDP components of it, but the same thing, it's not an HTTP layer attack. What you're finding is all of those networks are getting really good at blocking attacks into their network, right? Yeah. And that is where I started to think that DDoS would start to become more of a solved problem, when these big and very good at protecting themselves from attack networks were sitting in front of all the applications.
Well, and there's less coordination required when you're dealing with, you know, five major companies responsible for the vast majority of traffic, you know, in the countries that really use the internet the most, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, but as you said, it just keeps coming back. And there was another political one that I thought was super interesting too, that I was involved in. It was back in, I think, 2015. It was when GitHub got attacked by what was hypothesized or written about quite a bit was part of the from the Chinese government, because they were irritated that the Great Fire, which talks about how to circumvent the Great Firewall of China, was hosting, had content on GitHub. And the belief was that the Chinese government actually was injecting JavaScript on Baidu responses through the Great Firewall to have a browser automatically attack GitHub.
I mean, you hear stuff like that. You hear stuff like that, right? And you're like, okay, it's like not, you know, it's not an action that politically you'd agree with. But it's, I mean, being able to do that is quite, you know, it's pretty cool. Let's just admit it. You got to hand it to him. You know, that's clever.
That was the most sophisticated attack by far that I'd ever seen. Not just the JavaScript injection, but the way they did the attack. A lot of times, like we talked about earlier, they just do an NTP amplification attack at you. Boom, just send a whole bunch of traffic and hope you can't stop it. What they were able to do was pivot. They started by, you know, that HTTP based one that was based on that compromise or that injected JavaScript. Then they targeted infrastructure IPs. Then they targeted TLS exhaustion attacks. And they constantly were pivoting the type of attack that they would send at us, because it was very difficult to defend against, because it was so complex and it was so unique in how many different types of attack methods they used, right? This wasn't a single piece of malware that had like UDP attack, you know, ICMP flood and HTTP GET attack. This thing had a ton of different layers about it, and they used each of the different layers.
It makes sense to go top to bottom, right? Like, and that's all the great DDoS attacks. you know, there's going to be lots of packets flying at you. There's going to be complicated web-based requests. There's going to be TLS exhaustion's another great one, man. Like, fill up all of the state tables, try to exhaust memory, try to get queries going, try to get disk going, you know, just hit everything all at once. But like, it does feel like, though, to a degree, that it's not really viable anymore to DDoS websites that are protected by mainstream CDNs, right? To the point where they're going to have major downtime. Like, the web in that regard is a lot more resilient. And would you be surprised if a DDoS crew could, say, knock a major airline's booking portal offline if it was protected by a CDN? I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I'm guessing if they were down, it's going to be hours, not days, right? Would you agree with that?
All I'll say is that there are some very sophisticated attacks out there, and that a lot of times there's that type of outage that's not meant to be a DDoS, but turns into a DDoS. A good example of that is, you know, if you've heard of the term shoebot, right? Or like when a new pair of Yeezys or some other great shoe comes out, you have all these bots that are trying to scrape the e-commerce sites to try and buy those shoes so that they can resell them on the open market or whatnot, right? It's like just like tickets to a concert. It's any kind of like
scalping. You know, it's just scalping.
It's any kind of scalping, right? Now, these bots are really good and they generate a lot of traffic and they look just like legitimate users. So it's not easy to just say, oh, of course I could filter out that. I could tell when that's like, you get a really nice set of, you know, nice Google or a headless Chrome and you script in some, you know, what looks like human interactions. That's not easy to defend against. And that's what makes some of this stuff so complex and why you continue to have.
So are you telling me so many people are trying to get their hands on the Yeezys that they wind up DOSing the app?
That has happened multiple times. I've seen in different areas. Yes. So, yeah. That's why bots are such a complicated problem right now for a lot of customers for across the board, you know, not just our customers, but everybody's customers.
But I mean, that's an accident. As you said, that's, you know, the denial of service is sort of a byproduct of what the attack is trying to achieve there, which is, you know, you're probably going to make more money scalping Yeezys than you are by doing DDoS, right? Which is the crazy thing. So, you know, I guess I know it's hard to ask you to make some sort of definitive call, but is the age of DDoS, you know, it felt like it was coming back a little. I feel like, let's put it this way, right? I think the fact that the DDoS crews currently are targeting stuff like SIP telephony is kind of a good sign because it shows us that they're not having much luck targeting websites, right? So they're sort of being pushed to the edge. They're being pushed to the edges. They're being pushed into sort of, I mean, I wouldn't call SIP an obscure service, but it's certainly a much more obscure service than web or email, for example. So, which, funnily enough, we have seen some DDoS attacks against email providers recently. So I guess the question is, do you feel like this is a battle that we are winning and that DDoS is something that, while we're always going to have to defend against it, isn't going to be the sort of thing that's going to majorly disrupt the internet and core services on it?
I think we're doing good work. I don't think it's solved. No, I just think that attackers are too crafty. The internet is too important. I mean, even like the interesting thing will be, you know, if you remember back in the day, you know, probably, you know, you probably remember this, where like you couldn't open the firewall for a particular application. So you just tunneled it through HTTP, right? Because HTTP was always enabled in the firewall. So you always just saw people tunneling things through HTTP. That's what we're seeing a lot of these protocols move to as well. Like, I wouldn't be surprised someday if SIP starts to get tunneled via, you know, QUIC and some of the technologies there. Email, same thing, where you'll start to have so many of these, you won't have so many of these protocols. They'll all be tunneled under something like a QUIC or HTTP3 or one of those. So then the defenses that you've built for those protocols will be able to be used by more than just HTTP, right? There'll be a lot of different protocols, but then they'll just pivot back and they'll focus all their efforts there. I just think, like you said, email and SIP is pretty easy right now because people stopped paying for DDoS protection for those because they moved all their most critical things behind HTTP assets, but they're still super important. And
that's the thing. They're just targeting what's left over, right? Like, they're targeting the stuff that people have neglected until now. But it's not going to be that hard to fix it, I can't imagine. You know, I mean, I think the most recent attack, it cost bandwidth.com $12 million bucks in downtime. you know, and this is for a group where they're asking for ransoms in the order of a few thousand bucks.
Yeah, it's nutty. I want to say we're doing good work. We've got great detection methods, but like, I will definitely not say that it's a solved problem because people pivot. Like we keep saying, we keep thinking DDoS is gone and then it comes back. 4 years later, it's back and then it goes away and then it comes back. So it'll be back and it's kind of back right now. The Mara stuff, the GitLab attacks that kind of came out today that are, you know, there's just too many mechanisms for throwing a whole lot of packets at people. And it gets challenging to be able to discern real traffic from fake traffic, right?
That's yeah. constant. Now we've got a lot of CISOs who listen to this program. I guess I'm sitting there and I'm thinking I'm them and I'm listening to this. And what am I thinking? I'm thinking, well, you know, do I really need to sit down and think about this a little bit more in detail than maybe I have in the past, right? Because previously it's like, okay, our website, yes, it's behind a CDN. Yes, they've got good DDoS, you know, okay, our data center link, yes, that is protected. You know, all of our upstream, everything, all of our branch offices, you know, it's unlikely anyone's going to DDoS those links because we've got the protection. But I guess what you're saying is maybe people need to think about the more obscure areas where they need to think about getting hit creatively is like what I'm getting at.
Yeah, it's just like your attack service management normally, right? Like, what do I have and what's the risks to it? I think people forget all the time about all the things they're not thinking about. You called out SIP, there's email, there's third-party providers. I mean, pretty much everything is dependent on some sort of third-party API right now. Are they protected? Because if they're down, you're down. So it's all about it, you know, itemizing all of your assets and figuring out the highest risk ones. And then what you'll do if it's attacked. That was something I used to talk to folks about quite a bit was, what's the plan? Like, yeah. Just assume, and this isn't like some like, you know, scared tactic, like you're going to get hit, but it's more like you probably will at some point. It's just like,
it's not like you're going to get hit. It's more like, well, you're probably going to get hit. You're probably just going to get hit. It's saying exactly the same thing, only karma.
Yes. So you probably will get hit. And if you do, what are you going to do? Because the entire company grinds to a halt at that point, right? It's not just security. It's not just tech. It's like, if you can't process orders, it goes up to the CEO, like the entire company is affected when an attack hits. So I usually would just recommend to people is just have a plan that says, if we get attacked, what are the steps? Who do we call? What's our Rolodex look like? You know, we talked about at the very beginning, like who can you call that has a label on a router that might be able to help you out, but just itemize who you would call, what it will affect, and then have a plan around that. Just so you know,
what I'd call weakest link analysis would probably make sense because I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, which is by and large, HTTP services are pretty much under control. But attackers are now, and I feel like with this VoIP SIP stuff, like that's what we're, you know, SIP voice stuff. That's what we're seeing is we're seeing them going, this is a bit of a weak link. Right. And I reckon that's a trend we could see continue. And you're right, things like API endpoints that might not be well protected. And some of those APIs, you know, they're going to have bugs in them where you can send certain queries to them that are going to slow them down. And that's the sort of stuff that I think we could see is more, you know, specific application specific stuff at high volume, right? When attacking the stuff people haven't thought to defend, which is always the way, you know, that's how hacking works as well, right? So,
and we've seen that with GraphQL, right? You know, pretty much most people are starting to use GraphQL from an API perspective. They figured out how to secure REST and how to protect REST from, you know, attacks. But GraphQL, you can do some interesting things where you have like recursive queries that happen based on sending particular, you know, query strings at the queries at the GraphQL server. So the challenge is there's new stuff all the time that people want to play with. And maybe that the HTTP stuff can be protected, but I would also argue too, there's a whole lot of people that don't have protection in place for their HTTP assets. So they don't have a thing like bot protection. They don't have DDoS protection. They may have caching enabled, but that doesn't mean they have bot protection in place and DDoS protection in place, because those are things that you actually have to set up and configure in advance to give you the true protection that you need, right? And then developers are amazing. They love to use new technology. You have to make sure that those tools and technologies you've put in place protect against that new technology, like a GraphQL or something like that. So you constantly have to be thinking about it. You can't just put something in front of your sites and APIs and say, I'm done, I'm protected, right? You have to just kind of keep, you have to, with anything else in security, you have to keep up to date with it.
Yeah. Oh, great. One more thing in the inbox. Thanks a lot, Sean. Yeah.
Apologies.
All right, man. Like, that was a really interesting conversation about a topic that, you know, well, I guess that's the point, isn't it? It's kind of a topic we neglect because it's, from a technology perspective, I mean, there are interesting facets to it, but it's kind of boring, you know, in the sense that we're just talking about knocking stuff over. It's not about sweet techniques and, you know, doing mad deserialization stuff that gets you a shell. It's just like throw traffic at thing and make thing fall over, right?
Yeah, it's simplistic in its goals, but I'll tell you, I love researching it and learning about it, and attackers are crafty. So I recommend everybody just go look at some of the old attacks and what they did.
Yeah. It gets interesting when you get into the weeds. That's what I mean. Like at a surface level, it appears boring, but which is why we neglect it. But there is interesting stuff in there, as evidenced by the fact that we've been talking for like 40 minutes now about it. Sean Leach, thank you so much for joining us for this Soapbox special to talk about, the history of DDoS and kind of where it's going, which I think we've both can kind of say we don't really know where it's going, just that it's not a solved problem. It's all been very interesting stuff. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That was Sean Leach of Fastly there with a chat about the history and current state of DDoS attacks. I do hope you enjoyed it. And you can check out Fastly at fastly.com. That is fastly.com. And that is it for this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. I will be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.